Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Monica Brain. Coming up in this hour, the U.S. Supreme Court is kicking the can down the road on the case that involves criminal jurisdiction in Oklahoma. The governor of California apologized for past violence against Native Americans, and he called it genocide. And a classroom in Ohio decided to cancel a debate on offensive Native mascots. Also, matching Native actors with Native comic book characters. It's our news roundup. We'll be right back.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A Utah high school prohibited a Navajo student from wearing eagle feathers on her graduation cap during the school's commencement ceremony. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Tashina Savala was waiting to walk up to receive her diploma when a teacher noticed the three feathers and demanded she remove them. The Lehigh High School principal told the paper the teacher was enforcing a policy against decorating graduation caps, and he said the removal of the feathers was a misunderstanding. He implies Savala could have worn the regalia had she arranged it with school administrators beforehand. The Tribune reports Savala is one of seven Native students of the more than 1,500 students at the school. Tribal leaders in southeast Alaska are pushing for a change in mining law. The Klukwan tribal government is hoping to stop a proposed copper mine at the headwaters of the Chilkat River they say threatens their existence. KHNS's Claire Strempel reports.
Tribal President Kimberly Strong says that an international mining interest upstream poses an existential threat to thousands of years of Tlingit history.
I don't want to go down in history as the last tribal leader of the Chilkat Indian village of Klukwan.
She fears tailings from Constantine Metal Resources' proposed copper-zinc mine could pollute the river that sustains tribal citizens.
The Chilkat River feeds us financially, culturally, spiritually, and literally. And the toxic discharge of a mine directly upstream will wipe us off the map.
She met with lawmakers in Washington, D.C. that want to change a century-old law and reform the mining industry. Her message was well-received by Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva. In his view, the mining law of 1872 is outdated.
The fundamental reform of an industry. It's just not the old West, it's the new West, with different demands for the use of our natural resources and an increased ethic of conservation and protection.
Grijalva sponsored a new bill. It would allow federal agencies to deny mining claims on public land. A representative from the National Mining Association said the legislation jeopardizes the mining industry in Alaska and across the country. Representative Grijalva says existing law makes permitting a closed process, but the reform would require meaningful consultation with tribes. That's something the Klukwan Tlingit say they were denied by Alaska's Dunleavy administration in regards to the Constantine claim. For National Native News, I'm Claire Strempel.
The man who pleaded guilty to kidnapping, raping, and murdering a young Navajo girl in 2016 is seeking to reverse his life sentence. The Farmington Daily Times reports Tom Begay Jr. has filed a motion in federal court stating he didn't have a competent attorney and he was not aware of his rights. Begay said he has a low IQ and didn't understand the charges against him. Begay also argued he was drunk on the day he kidnapped Ashlyn Mike, and therefore the crime could not be a premeditated act of first-degree murder. He's seeking an evidentiary hearing and a lesser charge. The Tribal Council for the Picayune Rancheria of Chukchansi Indians voted this week to suspend memberships of 60 people. The suspensions are pending formal disenrollment hearings. The vote reverses an action 2 years ago to grant tribal status to the same 60 people. In a written statement to the Fresno Bee, Tribal Council Chairwoman Jennifer Ruiz said those subject to the suspension do not meet the requirements for tribal enrollment. It's the latest in a series of tumultuous enrollment decisions by the tribe, which operates the Chukchansi Gold Resort and Casino. Over the last decade, the tribe has disenrolled hundreds of one-time members. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Native National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. What AARP does might surprise you, like supporting the 98th Indian Market, taking place August 17th and 18th in Santa Fe. More at aarp.org/Native Origins.
My day one.
Telling inspiring stories of alcohol recovery. Recovery works. Hope starts here. Go to recoveralaska.org to learn more.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Are Native mascots offensive? That was the question for an 11th grade class debate in Yellow Springs, Ohio. But the school canceled the debate after a Native parent spoke up. We'll talk with the parent about what prompted her concerns. And speaking of debate, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, apologized to Native Americans for past historical violence, and he used the word genocide. We'll hear who was there and who was not there at the announcement. And we'll catch up with up on our Native entertainment news with Indian Country Today associate editor Vincent Schilling. He did Marvel's work for them and picked Native actors to play characters. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court was expected to hand down a ruling on Carpenter versus Murphy, a case involving the Muscogee Creek Nation, or was or was not disestablished. Instead, they sent the case for re-argument in the fall. Here to unpack this for us is Forrest Tadanipa. He's a partner at Dorsey and Whitney LLP, and he is a member of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma. Welcome back, Forrest.
Thank you. Good to be back, and certainly a surprising move by the Supreme Court yesterday.
Yeah, for the last two weeks, I have been waiting to hear hear a ruling, and there's been so much speculation. And then Thursday was basically the last day, or I think it was Wednesday was their last day to hand down a ruling. And what they came up with was nothing.
That's right. They essentially just kicked the can down the road, as we heard in the introduction, and set a rehearing for next term. So next year they will have another oral argument. They had previously asked for supplemental briefing, so you would expect the oral argument to focus on that supplemental briefing, but I suppose they could ask any question about anything, and we won't know until they hold that argument.
And we did a whole hour on this case because, it's pretty significant. The case is pretty significant, and we're also hearing a lot of headlines about, half of Oklahoma will be, using terms like returned and things like that. Forrest, can you, just sort of give a brief summary of what is actually the reality in this situation?
Yeah, the court is called upon to determine whether the exterior boundaries of the Muscogee Creek Reservation were ever disestablished. And in the context of the actual case at issue, the consequence determines whether there would be state or federal jurisdiction over a murder. The state exercised jurisdiction over a murder charge, and the defendant was convicted. He was sentenced to death. But throughout his proceedings argued that the state didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute him, but instead, under the Major Crimes Act, it rested entirely with the federal government. I think most of the kind of media coverage about the significance of reservation boundaries is a little bit overblown. I mean, it certainly has significance in a lot of kind of jurisdictional issues, certainly major crimes being one. There's ICWA implications, whether a case is occurring on or off reservation. There might be some other kind of criminal statutes, alcohol, liquor regulations that are at play. But obviously, you know, there's not like land is going to be taken from people that own homes in Tulsa and turned over to the Muscogee Creek tribe. It's not that type of drastic decision.
My understanding was from the state's arguments, though, that they kind of veered towards that catastrophic situation. You know, I'm curious to know what you think happened with the Supreme Court justices, why they just simply did not make a decision on this and are asking to rehear the whole case.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly surprising. I hadn't encountered this type of thing previously before. I asked around with our appellate practice here at Dorsey & Whitney, and the head of the group told me it was certainly very uncommon, but it isn't totally unprecedented. So it has happened in other cases at other times before. But I think the general consensus among everyone that I've talked to, and you know, my personal feelings too, is it must mean that there was a 4-4 split. But even then, it's kind of unusual because the composition of the court isn't expected to change. You know, it was 4-4 not because there was someone that was sick and couldn't attend, but it was 4-4 because Gorsuch has recused himself, and it seems unlikely that he is going to unrecuse himself and return to considering the case. It also seems unlikely that the composition of the court is going to change in any way. So for that reason, kind of you would think that they would just let the 4-4 split be the 4-4 split. So kind of speculating, and again, this is admittedly 100% speculation, but my personal speculation is that there must be somebody or more than one person, more than one justice that is very much on the fence, very much could be a swing vote, and they wanted to see if that person would alter their vote one way or the other with another with a re-argument or another argument.
Because I should explain to the listeners, because a 4-4 split means that the previous ruling stands and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals found in favor of Murphy and said that he should have been tried in federal court. So, I mean, does this point to anything in terms of what's going to happen or, you know, like how this court is or isn't leaning towards Indian country issues?
Yeah, I think it continues, you know, the other Supreme Court cases that we saw this term. I think it shows that maybe there's a trend that's continuing, and that trend is just to kind of adhere to what would be considered black letter law, basic law, which sometimes isn't always followed, or sometimes there's exceptions that are found, or, you know, it's construed in one way or another. But basically, you know, the black letter law on treaties is that you construe them in favor of the tribe, you know, construe them, interpret them as the tribe signing the treaty would have understood it, not according to what the English words necessarily are. And similarly to that, it's a canon that you have to clearly, Congress has to clearly disestablish a reservation in order to alter the boundaries. It can't be done by implication. It can't be done kind of just by practice on the ground, but Congress has to explicitly say we are disestablishing the boundary, and they never did that, which is why the 10th Circuit held that the boundaries hadn't been disestablished. So I think a 4-4 split shows, if that is the case, that there was a 4-4 split, and that's why they want to have a re-argument, it shows kind of that continuing trend where there is a closer adherence by the court to kind of traditional notions of what Indian law is.
Would this have any impact on your nation, on the Comanche Nation?
Not that I know of. I mean, certainly there could be arguments that were made, but, you know, we're in western Oklahoma, which has a little bit of a different history. The eastern Oklahoma tribes have a similar history, and that eastern Oklahoma was the Indian territory previously, whereas western Oklahoma, the Kiowas, Comanches, Apaches, southern Cheyenne, southern Arapaho, have a little bit of a different history, and that was actually a different territory. It was the Oklahoma Territory before statehood. So it wouldn't be directly applicable, but certainly for the eastern Oklahoma tribes, the Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, they would have be much more similarly situated to the Creek.
So is the Comanche Nation then disestablished? You don't have reservation boundaries?
That's certainly something I wouldn't admit, but the Tenth Circuit did use the Comanche Nation Treaty as one that demonstrates kind of where there are stronger congressional, more explicit congressional words showing disestablishment.
Well, Forrest, I'm wondering if you know, we're all playing the what if game. So what if the court decides, yes, they were disestablished, you know, when they after they rehear this and everything like that, what implications will that have for, I don't know, like the future of other reservations and things like that? Are we going to see now, like now a new window is opened up that also the Supreme Court could disestablish reservations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a scary proposition to think of what, you know, what if they did hold that it was disestablished because there is an absence of a clear congressional statement. So it certainly raises the specter of, you know, could there be other reservations that we don't think have been disestablished, or it certainly would be a lot more disputes about what the reservation boundaries are, depending on what rule they ultimately did articulate.
Is this something that you're interested in, Forrest? I know that like this week, I spent a lot of time on SCOTUS blog and reading and listening to things, learning more about this, and it made me feel like a little bit like a Supreme Court nerd, just a little bit though, not you know, not full blown. Do you spend a lot of time looking at Supreme Court cases, and you know, seeing what implications they have for Indian law?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially this recent term, I've been following all the cases very closely. I think they all have a lot of intellectual appeal, which all Supreme Court cases do, but also just the practical impacts that they have on, you know, things as basic as hunting, as basic as gasoline taxes, and now, you know, as fundamental as just the reservation boundaries themselves. So all very interesting and also definitely have, you know, pretty deep and significant practical implications.
Well, Forrest, thanks so much for coming on and unpacking this with us. We really appreciate it. Forrest Tadanipa is a partner at Dorsey Whitney LLP and a member of the Comanche Nation. And if you're curious about the law firm that he works at, we've got a link on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Also on our website, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's we send out to you what shows are coming up the next week and a little bit of information about our show. If you want to go to www.NativeAmericaCalling.com, and I think it's just a button on the right-hand side that says sign up here. You can click on that and sign up. We're going to go to a short break. It's our monthly news roundup, and we'll be right back. Fort Sill once held Apaches prisoner in the 1860s. It was also a Japanese-American internment camp in the 1940s. Now the U.S. government is planning on putting undocumented children there. Join us for the next Native America Calling as we focus on indigenous children mixed up in the growing number of detained asylum seekers.
Trickster Gallery welcomes all veterans to reconnect in unity and honor and celebrate in a traditional Native way. The 5th Annual National Gathering of American Indian Veterans at Cantigny Park, Wheaton, Illinois, July 26th to 28th, will include meetings with policymakers from D.C. and with healthcare, benefits, employment, and other service providers. Info about the weekend filled with teachings and cultural experiences at TricksterGallery.com, who support this show.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. It's our monthly news roundup. And if you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. Earlier, I mentioned that we're going to be talking about a situation in Yellow Springs, Ohio, where a school canceled a planned debate on the offensiveness of mascots. Joining us now is Jennifer Knickerbocker. She is the director of foundation relations at Antioch College, and she is from the Anishinaabe people, from White Earth Nation, from the Pillager Band, and she's an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
I should say a short disclosure that I am an Antioch alum. So Jennifer, you work at Antioch, which is in Yellow Springs, and your kids go to, is it Yellow Springs High School?
Yes, my children go to Yellow Springs High School. I have two sons that are there. I have a 10th grader, and then I have a middle schooler.
And so you found out that they were an 11th grade class, I think it was planning on having a debate on whether or not mascots were offensive. What did you do when you found out? Did you call the school or send a strongly worded letter?
Yes, well, I was out of town when I found out that the debate was planned. And so I wrote an email immediately talking about how it's inappropriate to have a debate on this issue, especially in Yellow Springs, Ohio, where there are very few Native people. Tribes had been eradicated in the late 1800s altogether. There's no governmental representation of Native people. There's no requirement within schools to have Indian education. And the debate was going to be giving students one side pro-mascot and one side against mascot. I was really worried that my son would be assigned either side, and then have to listen to these traumatizing arguments.
And so here's the thing is, though, I can see where the school was coming from, because debates create a situation where there's a higher level of critical thinking. And this is something education loves to do, which is like to challenge your ideas, to challenge your belief systems, and make you think outside of the box. And so what is the harm in asking, you know, particularly for a Native student, to consider the possibility that Native mascots aren't offensive?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we hear all the time about how debate is healthy and how it helps us see another person's position. And that was the intent, actually, of the teachers at the high school, was to show that in the end, there's very little evidence on the pro-Indian mascot side. However, debate takes apart an argument, and it gives points to people who kind of do a takedown. It rewards putting people off balance. It does not promote dialogue, however. It does not show intricate personal stories. It really just uses this kind of logic base versus the emotional base, which is what I think most Native people who've gone to a high school, who've experienced mascots themselves, it's where we come from. In my own personal life, in my story, I went to an all-white school with an Indian mascot. And my dad told me when I went to that school, he said, "Jennifer, there's going to be two Indians at this school, you and that mascot out front." And I had a really difficult time. I was teased. I was pushed. The high school coach groped me in front of the football players. I was threatened to be raped, all because of the way that the mascots portrayed our people. And I did not share my story. I know many, many people who also did not share their stories. That's not something that you can Google and use as an argument in a debate, is these dark secrets. And so for me, I had, when my son's class was planning a debate, I kind of had a Me Too mascot moment, and I really needed to give voice to this. I needed the students to know that bringing up these topics in a bifurcated way, a pro and con way, was traumatizing.
Yeah, wow. I went to a school that had an Indian mascot as well, and they sold big Indian burgers at lunch, and it was a challenging experience for me as well. I'm just curious, you know, you say you don't like the format of a debate. Would you feel comfortable with a discussion about it in the classroom, you know, maybe like a Socratic seminar or just a open-ended discussion where the teacher presents the question, the same question? Or do you feel like they should not be presenting that question? Are they offensive? Yes or no?
Well, I do think that question is a valid question. I think taking sides on an issue where you don't know very much and where you're in a space in Ohio that has the most mascots out of any state in the nation, it's skewed already. And so when we're looking at the question of should mascots be allowed, it really is up to the Indian people. It's not up to the general public. There's representation of Native people has to be up to Native people. That's my core belief. I know that it's the core belief of many other people. We can talk about it. We can have discussion and dialogue. We can remove the underlying values of debate that reinforce supremacist thinking of winning and losing sides of an issue. And we can work with acknowledgement and understanding of different viewpoints.
So, you know, what was the dialogue with the high school like? I know Yellow Springs is a pretty liberal town inside Ohio. Did it take a lot of convincing, or did they agree right away and cancel it?
They definitely did not agree right away. As a matter of fact, I think I was kind of white-splained or mansplained quite a bit. I wrote letters. I showed up in person. I spoke to the principal. I spoke to all the teachers. I spoke to the superintendent. I spoke to my colleagues at Antioch College. When I spoke to my colleagues at Antioch College, they really rallied behind me. They have coursework here on dialogue across difference, which is a really important pedagogy that addresses these issues of supremacy thinking. And they went to the school and they gave alternatives to this debate issue. However, in the end, the school did not change their mind about the debate until kind of the last minute, and when the newspaper got involved. And then they assigned all the students a new assignment of writing to some of the local high schools. There are 19 high schools in the county that have Indian mascots. And so they assigned all of the 10th grade students the requirement of telling them to remove the mascots. The students didn't like that at all. They thought that they were being told to create propaganda, and many of the students kind of rebelled. They started yelling pro-mascot chants in the cafeteria during lunchtime. And so that was an unfortunate side effect. Myself and my colleague, Shane Creeping Bear, then went to the high school And we talked with all of the high school students that we could, and just sat down and talked about our personal experiences with mascots and gave a little bit of Indian 101 and identity and talked about our rights to control our own images and our own, you know, sovereign way of being in all the different tribes. Every tribe has their own relationship with high schools and sports teams. And so there's not just one way of being. So we tried to explain those intricacies to the high school students, and that helped a little bit. But for weeks, it's been a topic in our local newspaper. And we're, you know, people have written in nationally about this debate topic in support of not debating this topic.
Well, how do you feel about how things turned out? Do you think that they could have been better?
Yes, things could have been better. But what I do appreciate very much is that now there's an open door. When I first moved to Yellow Springs, Ohio, a year and a half ago, it was in November and Native American Heritage Month, and there wasn't any activity going on in the schools or in the community. And now there's plans. Now there's plans to have, you know, Rock Your Mocks Day and you know, all the other things that we do and we learn about during Native American Heritage Month. So there's this wide open door. Antioch College also has been hosting Indigenous people on campus. We hosted about 50 people during World Peace and Prayer Day last week. Last night, we hosted a group of the Longest Walk who were coming through on their way to Columbus, Ohio, and we had a community discussion and dinner. Mm. We've been really just opening the door wide open because of these discussions. And that's been very energizing for our whole community.
Hmm. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this. We really appreciate it. And this will be an issue that we'll take a deeper look at about what's appropriate in the classroom when it comes to talking about difficult issues and debates and things like that. Jennifer Knickerbocker is the Director of Foundation Relations at Antioch College. And today is our monthly news roundup. If you have something you'd like to share, you can give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Also, if there's a news story that you'd like us to cover on this show, you can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Joining us now is Deborah Utasia-Kroll. She is an independent journalist, and she is Halon. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Deb.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. It's going to be 110 in Phoenix today, but not quite as hot as what happened on June the 18th when California Governor Gavin Newsom issued a formal apology to California Indians.
Yeah, so tell us about that. What did you think about the actual apology?
I think it was, you know, taking off my journalist hat for a moment and putting on my California Indian hat, I think it was a good first step. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. As we all know, the history of California, California and the United States engagement with California tribes has been extremely negative, has been it almost succeeded in wiping out our tribes. Fortunately, just like any other Native peoples throughout the Americas, we're pretty resilient and we are kind of bouncing back. Just like any apology, there's still a lot of questions in my mind that not only California Indians, but also Native people who live within the state should be asking. Even though there's been several moves over the past few years to kind of reverse the trend and to engage more positively with the indigenous peoples in California, first through an executive order issued by former Governor Brown in 2011 that requires all state agencies to engage with all indigenous peoples of California, whether or not they're federally recognized, which is a huge move because a good one-third of the indigenous peoples of California do not belong to a federally recognized tribe. And then there's some other amendments to the Environmental Quality Act, which incorporates indigenous environmental concerns into proposals for development or other such possible land and water uses. But then there's still on the other side that needs to be addressed. California is continuing to use these federal laws, such as Public Law 280, which grants the state jurisdiction over tribes in law enforcement in particular, and other federal laws and other Supreme Court decisions to try and dominate land use, wildlife, and marine life management, and other such activities, even as the top leaders are making some efforts to move away from that. One of the things I'm working on right now is a story for High Country News, which will be out, I don't know when, but it will be out pretty soon, I hope, talking about some of the conflicts between the federally recognized tribes in the state when it comes to coastal water management. Then, of course, there was a question of who wasn't there at this gathering. The non-recognized tribes weren't there. A lot of them are very concerned, at varying from being upset to kind of sighing and say, well, that's just the way it is. A lot of them are going to be watching this proposed Truth and Healing Council very, very, very carefully, as will I, putting my journalist hat back on. I believe it was Mark Trahant one time who said, when you start talking about California, it's complicated. And this is why we need more indigenous journalists who understand what's going on, like myself and some of the other indigenous California journalists, to follow these issues very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious to know what you thought about the fact that he used the word genocide. I know that that was used in Canada recently for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls inquiry. And so we're going to go to a short break. After the break, we'll talk to Deb about how Governor Gavin Newsom used the word genocide in his apology.
Program support from AmeriCorps Vista. AmeriCorps Vista members make a difference in the fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining valuable skills. We have rewarding service opportunities around the country, focusing on economic opportunity, healthy futures, education, and more. It will change your life and the lives of others. Information at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. It's our monthly news roundup. And Deb, before the break, we were talking about the apology Governor Gavin Newsom made in California. Were you surprised that he used the word genocide?
I was, particularly as the last time it was used by the prime minister in Canada, there was so much pushback. This time I noticed he did, after he used the word genocide, most of the California media agreed with him, probably because there's no doubt in the historical record that it really truly was a concerted policy of genocide right from the governor on down.
Well, Deb, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll have you on again soon. You can talk about what else is going on in California with California natives. We appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for having me on, Monica.
And it's our monthly news roundup, 1-800-996-2848. Earlier this month, we caught up with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert Wilkie. He's getting the word out about the Mission Act, which is designed to help veterans get the care they need faster, even if they need to go outside the VA system. This legislation came from a need to help veterans who weren't getting timely care and had to travel long distances to get treatment.
I created the standards for wait times and access and availability. It is thinking about the American West, forcing people to drive hundreds of miles to a VA facility when we may be able to provide them services before they even get to us. So what happens is the veteran's information is already in the computer. The computer tells us how far away that veteran lives from a VA facility. It also tells us how many days that veteran has to wait. And then it comes up with alternatives in the private sector for that veteran to take advantage of. What this isn't, it's not libertarian VA in the sense that we give somebody a card and say, go out and find what you need in the private sector. It says that we give you the option of going in the private sector when we can't provide those services. Now, the good thing that's happened in the VA in the last year is that our wait times have gotten much better across the country. The Journal of the American Medical Association in January said that our wait times across the board are as good or better than any in the private sector. We're getting better even than those statistics. So that helps. The crux of the issue, I think, is for those veterans coming into the system. It hasn't been much of a problem for veterans within the system to get those appointments. The problem has been for new veterans and the wait times that come with new appointments. We're not divorced from the rest of the country in the sense that we have many of the same issues that the private sector has. I mean, in many of our cities, it's very hard to get initial appointments within a reasonable amount of time.
That was Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie. If you want to hear our whole interview with him, we'll have it up on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. All right, now let's talk with Vincent Schilling. He's the associate editor of Indian Country Today, and he is Akwesasne Mohawk. Welcome back, Vince.
Hey, Monica, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
As always.
Yeah, of course. I had something in the intro about using my comic, the comic book guy in The Simpsons voice for this interview, but surprisingly, my editor cut that out. So,
hey.
No. So, I mean, I love this. I love this article. It's time for a Native Marvel movie. 10 existing Native Marvel heroes and 10 Native actors to play them. You're so fed up that you're like, fine, I'm going to do your work for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm like going to go write a script. I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to be like, but you know, it's a lot more convoluted than that to get a movie out there. There's a massive process, you know. So I thought about it and I was like, well, you know, how can I get the? It's not like I can go walk up to, you know, execs at Marvel and just hand them a script and be like, look, do this movie. So I was like, I thought of the voice I do have, and it's a voice to Indian Country, and to say, hey, you know, as someone who can post articles, and I do a weekly Native Nerd column, you know, because I love movies and comics and all that stuff. And So I said, look, I'm going to do it myself. I'll fan cast this myself. And it went viral. I was like, whoa. I mean, thousands of people were responding. And my gosh, my emails were going, you know, ballistic, and tons of positive response. The only regret I have is that I couldn't put more Native actors in more. I mean, it just, you know, because there are so many talented Native actors, and I wanted to use everyone. You know what I'm saying? But it would be a 9 million, you know, mile long article.
Well, there's only a limited number of Marvel characters, though, that are Native as well.
Well, actually, believe it or not, I've been doing research for quite a long time, and there's about 75.
Wow, so, 75.
Yeah. That have been around for decades, believe it or not. Some of them are pretty extremely stereotypical.
Right.
But, you know, I have to give credit to Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Chris Claremont, all these guys who really did try to represent all, you know, races and diversity. And these were non-Native guys, you know, they don't have all the cultural implications of everything to do that's completely sound. So I, to be completely honest with you, love what they did. You know, yeah, okay, most Native, you know, heroes, they have a hawk on their shoulder, or, you know, expert superior tracking abilities. You know, I get it, but but at least Forge, you know, he's kind of an inventor. He's like the MacGyver of superheroes, and he's Native guy. So it's, you know, I love it. I think Marvel needs to step up. I don't know if any of the listeners out there have seen Black Panther. I'm sure quite a few of them have. But, you know, it was wildly popular in the sense that they were talking about, you know, going against colonialism and joking it and saying how, you know, our intellect is superior to the colonist ways. And I was just like, oh, my gosh, they are just going for it in this movie, you know. So that said, you know, we're ready. You know, we're ready for it. And I think America's ready for it, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. We had a show about museums and repatriation. And one of our guests said something like, there's the before and after Black Panther because of the conversation in the museum in Black Panther about, you know, stealing things and stuff like that. I was wondering if you could just pick maybe like one or two that you picked in this list that you could talk about why you think that they're the best one for that character.
Okay, we'll see. There's a lot of history. Now, I'll talk about my lead image, of course, Lauren Anthony, right? He's right there, muscle boy, you know, with next to the Puma.
Uh-huh.
And Lauren Anthony, not only is he just a close friend, you know, I talk to him all the time, social media. He's been on my Native Trailblazers program and stuff, and I just love the guy, but a lot of people don't realize the history of Lauren. Lauren Anthony was one of the original actors that walked off the set of the Adam Sandler movie, Ridiculous Six.
Wow.
And he has come full circle and continued. A lot of people are like, you'll never work again, and man, are you out of your mind? And he kept working, and he's doing a ton of stuff. He's consistently working, and I just think his stature and his, you know, how he looks in these recent images he put on Instagram, he just looks like the Puma, who's part, you know, part Native, probably Navajo, and, you know, can turn into, you know, kind of transform into this Puma-like character. And so it just came across that way to me. And another one that I chose was Sivana Leiva-Rose, who plays Echo, who would play Echo. And I don't know if some of their listeners are familiar, but Sivana Leiva-Rose played Sasha Yazzie on the recent incarnation of Chambers that was put out by Netflix. And, you know, she played literally the first female Native lead role on a television online series ever.
Yeah.
She was the lead. And, you know, the thing, she is a dancer and an artist. And the neat thing about Echo is deaf. But she is an expert, like a mutant, that can perfectly mirror anyone's movements. So if someone is like a martial artist or something, she can move exactly like them. And, you know, going one more with Chambers, Marcus Lavoie as Forge. I just think the guy is just, he just is Forge to me. You know, you see the picture, they both have goatees. They're both really stocky, tough guy. And he's got this real tough guy look. And, you know, those are three of my favorites. Of course, you know, I like Wes Studi as Centurion, and Centurion is essentially a god of sorts, and that just kind of fit to me. You know, Wes Studi, you know, the god. You know,
yeah, you know, we had Sivan and Marcus on, and we did a whole hour about Chambers and talked about you know, the challenges of doing things like taking on subjects like that. And right after that, then Netflix announced that they were going to cancel it. And I saw your headline. You said that Indian Country was reeling from it.
Also, just a little bit. Yeah, and that's the article I put is Indian Country reels after the Chambers Netflix has been canceled. Another story that got a lot of traction on Indian Country Today. You know, 1 week prior to that, Netflix makes an announcement, submitting a press release to all media outlets across the country and internationally that they're going to be doing more indigenous outreach, specifically in Canada. And, you know, literally 7 days later, they cancel Chambers. I'm like, really? Really, Netflix?
Have you reached out to them to try and get an interview or talk?
Oh, yeah, I got their basic comment, you know, but I you know, based upon ethical nature, I can't discuss what I discuss with them because they would talk to me, you know, but they could only put out an official statement.
Sure.
But, you know,
sure.
I expressed my feelings. That's all I can really say. But, you know, I mean, it's the nice thing is, I'll tell you, is media and things like this Marvel movie and that I said and Chambers and all these things going on is we as Indian Country, I do feel as far as media, arts, entertainment, television are getting a stronger and stronger voice every day because, you know, a lot of people say, well, Native Americans are only a very small percentage of the population, so, you know, they don't have as big of a voice, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is we are 500% more annoyed at things that are unfair, so our voice will be exponential on social
media. It counts for more.
Yeah, while most people might be like, whatever. We'll be like, I'm not standing for it. You know, so you know, 5 million people will tweet. So our voices are being heard. You know, keep it up, Indian Country. You know, and that's part of the reason I suspected. Now I never know, but I suspected the article about the Marvel movie would get some traction, and it was really wonderful to see so much support and sharing of it that, you know, it is possible. Marvel, why not? I will give you kind of a sneak insight that I haven't really said to anyone yet, is I'm working on a similar article for a possible DC movie, so that way I can fan cast some more.
Oh yeah!
So stay tuned. That'll be coming out.
Yeah, you don't want to leave them out.
No, of course not. I also want to put some more actors who I really like what they do. I mean, you've got you know, Jean Braverock, who was in Wonder Woman, who did just a spectacular job. And, you know, there's a lot of great Native men and women actors out there who are doing wonderful stuff, and I want to try and lend even more voice. And then if anyone out there is a Native actor that's listening or knows of a Native actor they would like to suggest, I am compiling an entire list. You know, IMDb has some stuff, but please, you know, if folks want to reach out to me, I'm on Twitter, at Vince Schilling. They can send me an email of any actor, their IMDb profile, anything I can. I'm going to try and keep a database for if any people are looking for Native actors. I want to have a resource right there they can click on or find the IMDb or, you know, trying to do anything I can to reach out to you know, those who are working tough in the industry. You know, you got to give them credit for the work they do.
Yeah, we'll put your email on our website, nativeamericacalling.com, if people want to reach out. I love Indian Country Today and their databases. They're exceedingly useful. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of the hour. I want to talk about Michael Gray Eyes. He's going to be a vampire?
Well, he's going to be, you know, I don't know. Well, you never know. It's kind of like that's like asking if Rip Grimes is going to be a zombie. You don't really know in Walking Dead who's going to get what, or, you know, or excuse me, Kayla Taka Walker, who was Fear the Walking Dead, Michael Gray Eyes. But he told me before any press knew about it that he is going to be playing a motorcycle bad boy, Jimmy Saint, in the upcoming Netflix series V-Wars, which is based on a virus outbreak that the virus causes people to become vampires. So it's essentially an apocalypse thriller based upon the novel of the same name, V-Wars. And he was telling me about it, and there's some stuff he told me that I can't reveal because it's kind of spoiler stuff, but oh my God, it sounds so spectacular. I just cannot wait. I'm a vampire fanatic. I love that type of stuff, you know. So
I thought vampires were over. I thought we were done with that.
Well, he said, you know, he even said, he goes, well, the genre is kind of like whatever pieces, but I'm telling you, Vincent, he goes, because it's a virus and it's a little bit different, like people may react differently depending on how they are reacting to the virus. And he says, in that, it's really, really exciting. He says, it's really bloody and really, like, just violent. And I was like, perfect, I'm there. You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, I wasn't really a fan of Brad Pitt as, you know, Lestat and all that. But I'll tell you, the thought of Michael Gray Eyes in this is exciting. I just love his work anyway. He's just a tremendous actor. So I'm really looking forward to something like this.
Yeah, I can see a lot of people probably wanting to borrow folks' Netflix passwords. Well, we've reached the end of our hour. Thank you so much to everybody who joined the show today, in particular Vincent Schilling, Deb Kroll, Jennifer Knickerbocker, and Forrest Tadanipa. Our full interview with the Secretary of the VA, Robert Wilkie, will be on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Tara Gatewood. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Thanks to our intern, Sol Traverso. Nola Davis-Moses is the distribution director, and Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our resource development specialist. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations, and the president and CEO of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
Native Americans affected by domestic violence can call the Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering free confidential support and resources. Strong Hearts takes calls from anyone hurting in their relationship or who may be concerned for someone else. Available 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Central Time, 7 days a week at 844-7-NATIVE. That's 844-7-NATIVE. More at strongheartshelpline.org. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Haumi takia piki. Wichaki ni tchatsa awanki glaka umpo. Wichosa ni wash agia ya unktelo ni tiwahe na ni tioshpeaki ob. Lili samaya wasole anktelo. Medicaid.gov nish lakhol zania wawoki kichi woglakayo. Le wot khaniki Medicare na Medicaid otiet na hielo. Ho, hechetuelo.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.